Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Evelyn Pierce, guest host of Prosody. My guest today is the novelist and short story writer, Leslie Petrick. She's the 2015 Drew Hines Literature Prize winner. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You know, Leslie, it would be great if you would just begin by reading something from this fine collection. I know you've chosen a piece called 10 Things.
Yes, I will. This is the opening story in the book, and even though it's called 10 Things, I will be reading two of 10 Things. So,
great.
10 Things. These are 10 things that only you know now. He joked that he would die young. You imagined 99 to your 100. But by young, he meant 65, 55. What young ended up meaning was 35. In the memory book the funeral home gave you, actually that you paid for, nothing there was free, not even delivering the flowers to a nursing home the next day, which cost $65, but you were too used up to care. In the book, there was a page to record his exact age in years, months, and days. You added hours. You even added minutes because you had that information. You were there when he had the heart attack. Now, when thinking about his life, it seemed to you that minutes were so very important. There was that moment in the emergency room when you begged for 10 more minutes. You would have traded anything, everything, for one more second, for the speck of time it would take to say his name, to hear him say your name. Later, when you thought about it, because suddenly there was so much time to think, too little time, too much, time was just one more thing you couldn't make sense of anymore. You wondered why he'd told you he was going to die young. The first time he said it, you punched his arm. Don't say that, you said. Don't ever say that again, ever. But he said it another day, and lots of days after that. And you punched his shoulder every time because it was bad luck, bad mental energy. But you knew he'd say it again. You knew then that there would always be one more time for everything. Two, he once compared you to an avocado. He was never good at saying what he meant in fancy ways. You had a boyfriend in college who dedicated poems to you, one of which won a contest in the student literary magazine, but that boyfriend never compared you to anything as simple and real as an avocado. You were sitting on the patio in the backyard. It was the day the dog got loose and ran out onto Route 50, and you found him by the side of the road, two legs mangled and blood everywhere, and you pulled off your windbreaker and wrapped the dog in it while your husband stood next to you whispering, oh God, because there was so much blood. He drove to the vet, catching every red light while you held the dog close and murmured dog secrets in his ear, feeling his warm blood soak your clothes. And when the vet said she was sorry that it was too late, you were the one who cupped the dog's head in both hands while she slipped in the needle. And you were the one who remembered to take off the dog's collar, unbuckling it slowly and looping it twice around your wrist. And you were the one whose face the dog tried to lick but couldn't quite reach. So that night, out on the patio, the two of you were sitting close, thinking about the dog. It was really too cold to be on the patio, but the dog had loved the backyard. Every tree was a personal friend, each squirrel or bird an encroaching enemy. It was just cold enough that you felt him shiver and he felt you shiver, but neither of you suggested going inside just yet. That's when he said, I've decided you're like an avocado. You almost didn't ask why. You were so busy thinking about the dog's tongue trying to reach your face and failing, even when you leaned right down next to his mouth. But then you asked anyway. He looked up at the dark sky. You're sort of tough on the outside, he said, a little intimidating. Maybe, you said, but you knew he was right. In photos, you always looked as if you didn't want to be there. Lost tourists never asked you for directions. They asked your husband. It was something you'd become used to and no longer thought about or wondered why anymore. He continued, but inside, you're soft and creamy, luscious, just like a perfectly ripe avocado. That's the part of you I get. And underneath that is the hardest, strongest core of anyone I know. Like how you were today at the vet, like how you are with everything, an avocado. At the time, you smiled and mumbled, but could only think about the dog, the poor dog. That was 5 years ago. What you remember now is not so much the dog's tongue, but being compared to an avocado.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Evelyn Pierce, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is Leslie Petrick. She's reading from her short story collection, This Angel on My Chest, and is the winner of the 2015 Drew Hines Literature Prize. Leslie, in the piece that you just read, I'm drawn into how you, and not just in this story, how you choose what could, for any of us, be an ordinary thing. And this one, the avocado, kind of stands out. And what you're able to do in this story and other stories is build tension into the moment of the use of that ordinary thing in such a way that I feel compels your narrator to kind of unfold something that's, you know, much more than the ordinary. Can you talk to us about, you know, how you do this, how that comes to you?
Oh, thank you. Well, this collection of stories is about the death of my first husband, who died when he was very young, and I was young. And so in each story, a young husband dies or has died. So it's a very personal book for me. And one of the things I think I was trying to show through this very personal to me loss, but universal story everybody has had or will have somebody they love die, is that what is most powerful is the ordinary, the little tiny things that are gone from your life when that person also is gone.
Yeah, and I feel like in the stories, and everyone has some of that ordinariness that becomes, as I said, extraordinary. I feel like you do it so beautifully. It makes me want to ask, too, about the title of the book. You know, so many writers, I believe, in their collections will choose the title of one of their stories to kind of then pull the whole book together. And your title is not the title of one of your stories. And so you take something ordinary like Angel, and I begin to want to read it in many different ways. This Angel on My Chest. Could you share with us how you chose the title and what all the ways that you would like for us to feel that as we're reading through the collection?
Well, I'm so happy you mentioned the title. I'm notoriously horrible at coming up with titles, so I worked very hard on finding a title. And it's interesting you say that most collections do have a story title as the title, because one of the stories in the book was called This Angel on My Chest, or I wanted to call it that, but the story, I guess, wanted to be called something else. The story won that battle. But I, once I had that phrase in my mind, which is sort of taken, adapted from a Bruce Springsteen song, not one of his biggest hits, but Backstreet's You're Like an Angel on My Chest. I heard that phrasing and I wanted that title for the book because angel implies death, and yet I'm not saying a positive part of death, but the less terrible part of death, that somebody lives on in a certain way. And then the heaviness of something on one's chest where one's heart is sort of spoke to me as to where the heart of the book is, that tension of having loved someone and lost someone and carrying that person forward with you for the rest of your life.
Yes, and each of the stories, I think, to me, bounces against the title of the book and just the way you've talked quite beautifully. Would you read again for us? I believe you have another selection that's from the story called A Quiz.
Yes, A Quiz. And again, there are seven parts to A Quiz, and I will just be reading the first two. And this story comes early on in the book, and to me, I wrote this story. This is the story that kind of explains how and why there might be a book of stories in which a young husband dies in every single story, because I admit that is not exactly what people expect to see, the same subject matter over and over. So I knew I had to set the reader up to understand what I was trying to do, and that's how I wrote a quiz. And it's in the form of a quiz, like you'd take in a magazine or on BuzzFeed. So a quiz. The following questions are multiple choice. Please select the option that best reflects the correct answer. Do not make more than one choice. Number one, you are at a housewarming party. You're wearing a new skirt that you bought half price earlier in the day because you went to the mall because you thought you shouldn't want to be alone. You don't know the hosts of the housewarming party, but your friend does, and she's supposed to be meeting you, but she's late. So you're standing in a corner holding a plastic cup of Pinot Grigio, discreetly trying to rip out the tacking threads you forgot to remove from the back slit of the skirt. A man approaches you. You know that most women your age, not quite 40, would find this also not quite 40 man attractive enough with his product bristled hair and loose smile, but you're annoyed that his front teeth are too big. You're annoyed that the tacking thread is stubborn and still there. You're annoyed that you're drinking Pinot Grigio at a party instead of Maker's Mark bourbon at your house alone. You're annoyed that your friend is late, that she's always late, even when she promises not to be late. The man says, "Hello, I'm Vince." You say, A, "Nice to meet you, Vince." B, "I'm not going to ask you what you do because everyone in Washington asks that, and isn't that so annoying?" And then laugh in a throaty, flirty, fetching way as you confess that you're a lawyer and wait for him to laugh and tell you that he is too. C, "Can you see this tacking thread in my skirt?" And then spin around, arching your back a bit as you point down to the thread, knowing he'll be happily confused by this sanctioned opportunity to stare at your butt. Laugh in a throaty, flirty, fetching way. Later, follow him to his place in your own car. D, "Hi, Vince. You're probably a nice guy, but you should know that my husband died of a brain aneurysm 6 months ago and he was only 42. The correct answer is D. Choose D. Vince will slither away, and when your friend hears what you've done, she'll threaten never to take you to another party. When you get home, you will pour bourbon into a tall glass and sip it slowly in front of the dark fireplace, obsessively rattling the ice cubes every couple of minutes. 2. You're at the grocery store, eyes scanning rows of canned tomatoes, diced, petite diced, whole, stewed, crushed, sauce with basil, sauce with garlic, diced with basil, diced with garlic, fire roasted, low sodium, no sodium, paste. In another aisle, there's also tomato juice. But you've forgotten what you're looking for, what you might have planned to cook with tomatoes. It's a breathless amount of choices and forms for just a tomato. Your cart is empty. You have stared at yogurt, at cereal, at detergent, and frozen vegetables and soup, but how is it possible to pick one, you wonder, terrified that you will make the wrong choice, that you will bring home the wrong form of tomato, the wrong cereal, that what you do will be wrong in some ill-defined way. Excuse me. It's a woman wearing black yoga pants and a too tight ponytail. Do you happen to know where the barley is? It's one of those things I can never seem to find. She smiles, the kind of woman skilled at netting people into her life, the kind of woman unafraid to ask for help or call for directions or beg for a favor or show need. Do you, A, smile back and say, "Aisle 4 near the rice on the bottom shelf." B, smile back and say, "Aisle 6 near the oatmeal," even though you know barley is actually in aisle 4 near the rice. C, not smile, but speak sincerely, "I'm sorry, I don't know." D, smile back and say, "Check near the rice, though you should know that my husband ate a lot of whole grains, but he died anyway of a brain aneurysm 6 months ago when he was only 42. You might as well eat Pop-Tarts every day." Keep smiling until your skin feels tight enough to snap off your face. The correct answer is D. Choose D. She will swing her cart around and barrel back up the aisle, ponytail sawing side to side. You will not buy tomatoes. You will abandon the cart in aisle 5 and slink out to the parking lot and sit in your car for 10 minutes in chilly silence, watching people load bags of groceries into the backs of their SUVs. you'll decide that maybe you wanted petite diced tomatoes for a jambalaya casserole that you used to make for Super Bowl parties and potlucks. At home for dinner, you'll eat the last can of the black beans from the emergency cupboard in the basement and chuckle bitterly when you see that the expiration date stamped on the top was 6 months ago. You will not bother heating the beans, and you'll eat them straight from the can, and you'll tell yourself they actually taste better that way.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Evelyn Pierce, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is Leslie Petrick. She's been reading from her short story collection, This Angel on My Chest, and this book won the Drew Hines Literary Prize for 2015. Leslie, in that piece that you just read from the story A Quiz, it's obvious that you're using second person. And not just the structure of a quiz, but the whole second person approach. And that was also in 10 Things. Of course, mm-hmm. some of the stories don't use second person. But I think that we don't often see second person used. We have seen it in some, you know, fabulous books like Bright Lights, Big City, yes. Jay McInerney's mm-hmm. book. I know Laurie Moore mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. worked with this. And I always find it, as a reader, you know, very compelling. I feel it, with these two pieces, especially that you've read from, that it's one time, you know, I'm invited in, another time I'm actually forced into this. Mm-hmm. And so could you talk a little bit and share why this point of view, you know, works for you, how mm-hmm. you hear it, why, how you come to it?
I am a big fan of the second person, although, and I love Laurie Moore and I love Bright Lights, Big City. I do understand that the second person can be a little bit off-putting for some readers. So I know it's a big risk, but I embrace it, and hopefully, I hope it works here. I think what I'm drawn to with the second person is this sense that it's a distancing technique, maybe for me, the writer, that I can say things in the second person, you, that's not me. And I know that the first person, I, is not me either, but there's a little bit of deniability in the second person. That person over there, you, that's the person doing these things. And I think that was important for me when I was writing this book, which is very personal and involves a lot of personal truth and facts from my life, that I wanted to step back a little bit and use that second person. And then also, as you're saying, this is both the strength and difficulty of the second person. It does plunge the reader right in there. And some readers don't want to be taken to that place.
You know, one of the things, though, I also feel it does for these stories and the book is it enables you, the writer, to kind of make the tragic and comic one at the same time. To me, it would be almost impossible to do that in first person. You know, and so I think our listeners could hear in this last selection that you read, some of these things are very funny, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. but at the same time, knowing why we're being asked to participate in this quiz through, mm-hmm. you know, that narrator's experience, it's so doggone sad at the same time. And so I think it's a beautiful use of second person. And you said if it works, it works so well.
Well, thank you.
You know, I really, really enjoy these. I know that you have another selection to read from us, and I think it's something that you're going to read in its entirety, Acquiescence.
Acquiescence, yes. It is a super short story that I guess I don't have to introduce or apologize for cutting off, because here it is, Acquiescence. The body flew on a different plane, arriving in Detroit 2 days ago at 7:37 a.m., She tracked its arrival online. Not a soldier or a famous politician, just her husband, age 30, suddenly dead. His mother wanted him buried in Detroit. Did it matter where someone's dead body was? Did it matter that someone's dead body ended up in the place they had fled? Now she was in suburban Detroit, being carried along an anonymous highway in his mother's Lincoln. People drove as if they were tense, feeling the crush of that low gray sky she remembered from their visit 2 Christmases ago. The graveside service was in an hour, followed by a celebration of life at a country club. There would probably be balloons released outside, heartfelt notes tied to them with ribbon. She stared at the parade of silver-paned office buildings out the window. His mother's voice was something broken that wouldn't stop making noise. Finally, they reached the cemetery, that modern kind, with stones flat in the ground to make mowing easy. The spot his mother selected seemed exposed, exactly in the center. She was taller than any of the slender trees. People pressed her hand, clutched limp tissues. There were old high school girlfriends, all pretty. Though it was cold, no hats. The box with the body in front, blanketed with white roses, a stand displaying his smiling graduation photo, a CD of songs he wrote for his college band, The Elements. The scene felt arranged, like a movie set of a sad funeral. She imagined everyone at home afterward, sponging off makeup, peeling away costumes, slipping into bathrobes to relax after this hard day of work. A minister with a square head spoke, "God this, heaven that." She'd heard it all before. His mother wept so loudly, the crows looping overhead were startled. When she exhaled, frost clouded the air. Later, his mother pulled up to the airport curb and said, "Promise you'll come visit," and they both knew she wouldn't. She watched people wheeling black suitcases in a hurry to leave Detroit. Though she didn't believe in God or heaven or worshiping a flat stone, she half envied those who did, those who thought it could be so simple. She said to her former mother-in-law, "Maybe spring. The marker will be in then," his mother said. "It was a beautiful ceremony," she said. "I'm so glad. All those Mylar balloons in the sky." "Did you get a photo?" his mother asked. She nodded, patting her coat pocket as if a phone was in there. "There's just one last thing." She hadn't cried today, and it was important that she not cry, as she said, "It was bugging me the whole time that maybe they'd put him in upside down." Upside down? That his head was where his feet should be. "They wouldn't do that," his mother said. "They don't make those kinds of mistakes. There's hinges on one side." "I kept thinking about it," she said, which was true. "I couldn't get it out of my head." His mother spoke urgently. "It doesn't happen like that. Don't lots of things happen that we think won't happen?" His mother tightened her face. "Have a safe trip." The sound of the car door opening, then closing, was loud. Strange not to have luggage to float so lightly. On the flight home, she knew there'd be a time she might wish she hadn't acquiesced to the anger nudging her to speak those unforgivable words to her former mother-in-law. But that wasn't today.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Evelyn Pierce, guest host this week, and my guest today is Leslie Petrick, reading another story from This Angel on My Chest, her collection that won the Drue Hines Literature Prize for 2015. Leslie, in this story, as you know, people can hear right at the end, the main character kind of pushes back, you know. Mm-hmm. All of this, it feels, has been pushed upon her. It feels to me that she hasn't had a lot of choice in what's been happening, you know, with the funeral mm-hmm. and all of that. And at the end, she just can't help herself mm-hmm. but to mm-hmm. express what she's, you know, feeling. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're kind of enabling all of your characters, though, to push back. Is it something that you feel as a writer you want to, you know, make sure you're doing, and you're doing it through the characters?
Oh, yes, that's a wonderful observation. My intention in writing these stories, when I came upon this project, I wanted to sort of capture all the different and sort of maybe the unknown and harder parts of what it's like to grieve the loss of someone and what really goes on behind. And believe me, I have nothing against balloons and heartfelt notes, so
yes.
I don't mean to sound bitter, but that there's so much more, and that sometimes the balloons cover up those hard and darker emotions that people are going through because they are traumatized and they've lost somebody. So many emotions they don't know how to process and handle. And so for me, this was a story to sort of show where that might bubble up and how. And I know that this narrator, the woman in that story, one day will feel sad that she sort of foisted this on her mother-in-law. But right now, she just had to do it kind of to maybe save herself a little bit.
And in your earlier works, too, you also have characters who are dealing with death, right? I remember, right. I read, you know, one of them. You've got to help me with your titles here. And I know that the character's dealing with the suicide of
her mother.
Right,
A Year and a Day.
Yes.
It's funny that you bring that up. So that's a novel about a teenage girl whose mother has committed suicide, and it's the year after that tragic event as she is grieving the loss of her mother. And to be honest, that, in my mind, was the book I wrote about the death of my husband, even though mm-hmm. there's no husband and no person who's like me, and it's about a mother, but it was about the grieving process. And so I sort of thought I was done writing about Rob's death, and then this book came.
Yes. And it's an act of bravery, wouldn't you say? I mean, maybe you don't want to call yourself brave, but it feels to me it's an act of bravery when any writer takes on the most difficult subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that many times throughout this collection in very fresh ways that I think are unexpected. We have time for you to read one more selection, I believe, and that's from Do You Believe in Ghosts? Is that the one that you want to go with, or do you want to go with Index of Food?
I'll do the Do You Believe in Ghosts.
Okay.
Because it's sort of a beginning. It's a beginning. And in this story, it's sort of a narrator who has buttonholed somebody in a bar and is telling sort of the story of her marriage. And so this is a more pleasant memory. So we met in college. He was a sophomore, and I was fringe in a pack of sweetly naive freshman girls, and we were all drunk at a frat party, and someone's idea was to catch the sun rising up out of Lake Michigan. He and I were the only two who actually watched. The others occupied themselves by jumping naked into the frigid water. So he walked me back to the dorm afterward, claiming it was dangerous on campus because of the rampaging wild boar. Not really. We're talking suburban Chicago. He was singing Springsteen. Born in the USA had come out that summer, and everyone was all about Springsteen. But this guy was into the early, great stuff. New York City Serenade and Sandy, hitting each word, every inflection. Anyone else, and this would have been crazy overboard, but he had these blue-green eyes and passion. Not copycatting Bruce's passion, but his own, pulling me like an undercurrent, like the waves pulling at the lake.
Thank you, Leslie. You've been listening to the writing of Leslie Petrick. Thank you so much for being here with us. You've also been listening to Prosody. It's WESA's weekly show that features the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper. It's the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.